Subhash Katil, who are with DRUMP, Desi's Rising Up and Moving, and also working on a campaign called Stop the Disappearances. So mon ami and Subhash.
Before I start, I want to say that it's very difficult for people who've not been inside prison walls to understand what kind of dehumanization that is and how many millions of people go through that level of dehumanization every day. I think activists tend to talk about it when we get targeted, you know, at rallies. But there are millions of people who are sitting in jails who are dehumanized simply because of the color of their skin and simply because of their immigration status. And I'm inspired by Shakir and his courage and the courage of so many other hundreds of people that we work with on a daily basis who, despite all of that, resist every day from inside. And make the attempts to organize, even though the risks and the dangers to them are so much more. We came across Shakir because Shakir has been organizing for himself and about the conditions in MDC. Shakir was really one of the first people who broke the entire detention issue in the U.S. His name came out because he contacted people. He contacted human rights organizations. He contacted lawyers. And many other people were not able to do that. And so Shakir, in so many ways, began the movement for justice for what's going on, for the disappeared in the U.S. And I want to really acknowledge that. Like Shakir, DRUMP, we've been working with so many other people that share stories similar to Shakir. In New York City alone, we think that to date, at least 2,000 people have been disappeared in such a way. Some of them are jailed in the same place that Shakir was, Metropolitan Detention Center, and most of them are in county jails in New Jersey. The vast majority of them are still sitting in these county jails. Many of them did not see a judge, a day in court, or a lawyer for months and months after they were detained. And the vast majority of them are also people who did not have families here, and people who were part of communities. But one thing that the media doesn't often tell us is that who are these people? If you look at New York City, the people who were targeted and picked up were people who did things like driving cabs and working in restaurants and working as street vendors. And these were the people that became highly visible all of a sudden and became highly targeted. I think one of the things that's happened in the U.S. in talking about the domestic, you know, war on terror has been that there's been a real strategic shift in the media to not talk about the issue of economics and class and who people are that are targeted. You know, over time, we've seen the media start to focus on, well, racial profiling is happening in the airports, and, you know, businessmen are being profiled when they are flown around. The fact is, thousands of people who are in detention are not taking planes across the country or across the globe for the most part. They were picked up right from their neighborhoods, right from their backyards, from kitchens of restaurants, five or six people at a time. And those are also the people who don't have access to the media and don't have access to legal counsel for the most part. So that's something that we really need to recognize and understand. I think we want to talk a little bit also about the racial profiling, because detention is one piece of what's going on in terms of the domestic war in the U.S., and it's probably the most, you know, the central piece. But there's so many different parts of that, so many different aspects of how the level of fear and repression is reaching out specifically to immigrant communities. And that includes racial profiling by both public agencies and institutions and also private institutions in the states. And it also includes policy changes that are affecting everything from education to housing to welfare. So I'm going to pass it on to Subhash, and he'll talk a little more about the details.
Yeah. I guess in terms of image, like after September 11th, the way the government put out its program of the war against terrorism was that this was something the people of America wanted. And I'm sure a lot of folks were in some of our previous discussions where we talked about how the war against terrorism was something that was in development for a very long time, right? But what's really important to look at is the images that help facilitate, like, even for people that thought that the war on terrorism in America is a good thing, like the types of images that were projected to constantly throw in people's faces as to why it was so important. And once again, here's where you draw the links between the war on terrorism and the war on drugs. And so with the war on drugs, for dozens of years, whether it was on TV or whether it was in the newspaper, you had images of young black men. Granted, the fact that the majority of people in America that used drugs were white, were middle class white folks. You constantly had images of black men, gold teeth, big chains, guns, gangs, bandanas. That any time people like started thinking the war on drugs was a bad idea and the criminalization of people was a bad idea and putting 2 million people in prison was a bad idea, you just constantly threw these images to scare people. This guy can deal drugs to your kids. And, you know, even in liberal, like really liberal, like movies like Traffic, you know, like you have these images of, well, this could happen to your kids, you know. They might go to a black neighborhood and buy drugs. And, you know, like these images are constantly thrown in people's faces to justify what has been the devastation of low-income and black and Latino communities. But the war on terrorism used the almost exact same tactic. Anytime people started thinking that maybe like all of this stuff of having like police officers with M16s in airports was like kind of crazy, or that like, you know, all these things that you had to do to like go like get a driver's license were crazy, they start throwing these images at people of these scary looking dark skinned men from, you know, God knows where, Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, all these other countries, and they could come in your living room, they could blow up everything. And anytime people started thinking like maybe this war on terrorism stuff is a bad idea, but do you remember this guy could come into your living room, you know, and constantly throwing these images in people's faces. Now, and so what I'm trying to say is that the reality versus the myth that was created by, and even like when I'm on panels with people like the head of Homeland Security, the first thing they say is, well, you know, the people wanted the Patriot Act, the people wanted this, the people wanted that. Why? Because 10 minutes, 15 minutes after the World Trade Center blew up, the first thing they showed was 15 Palestinian kids dancing in the street. You know, who knows what they were dancing for? They could have been dancing for someone's birthday or someone. But
it was a 13-year-old video from the Gulf War.
Exactly. And, you know, these images are constantly thrown in people's face. And so, like I said before, I mean, the reality of the fact of the matter is that this war on terrorism and war on drugs and like this war on people is starting to like consolidate itself. And the work that's been being done on detention right now, the work that Drum has been doing on detention for the past couple of years, has really been also trying to consolidate that fight against racial profiling, against police and prisons, and the different ways that like low-income people of color, immigrants of color's everyday lives have been criminalized, and there's a military presence, you know. So one of these talked about before about how there's cops in schools. You know, so the schools become a site of racial profiling, and the schools become a site of a prison where, like, you start having bars on walls, and, like, when you look going to school now in America, it's starting to more and more resemble prisons and more resemble, like, you know, military posts and, you know, like, checkpoints and things like that. And day-to-day lives of people that look like us and from communities that we're from are starting to resemble, like, prisons. And more importantly now, the day-to-day life of people of color, low-income people, immigrant people, is starting to represent something in which everyone you're talking to becomes an INS agent. Everyone you're talking to becomes an immigration official. You know, so we're dealing with, and Shakir talked about this, how the NYPD was acting as an agent of the INS. You know, how the school system is acting as an agent of the INS, how the places where you go to get your ID are acting as agents of the INS. And, you know, the selectivity of it.
In terms of the numbers, there's something that the Justice Department started called the Absconder Program. And under the Absconder Program, there's 314,000 people on this list. And absconders are those who have overstayed visas, right? And these are the people that the Justice Department announced they're going to actively go after, these 314,000 people. Out of this list, about 6,000 are supposed to be Arab and South Asian, and they're being put in a national criminal database. Or actually, not 6,000 from what they define as Al-Qaeda countries. And they're being put into a national...
I wasn't aware Al-Qaeda was a nationality.
Right, exactly. So they're being put into a criminal database. And what's happening also is that at the same time that the INS, you know, has got its tentacles expanding everywhere, it doesn't have the capacity. It's not the most efficient of agencies. It doesn't have the capacity to go do all of these things. So it's developing unprecedented levels of cooperation with local and federal law enforcement bodies, such as local police departments. There was something where there were basically written agreements between local police departments and the INS and the FBI that there was not allowed to be information sharing. They're called MOUs, Memorandums of Understanding. So what we're seeing now, though, is that there are proposals to basically eliminate, get rid of these memorandums of understanding. That's what they're saying officially. But in reality, they've been doing that. They've been sharing information since September 11th. Since that morning, the vast majority of people picked up were visited by, and you don't really know who these, you know, 10, 12 men in dark suits coming to see, wake you up from sleep are. But they were usually INS people, FBI people, New York City Police Department people. And that's just the official, the government side of it. In New York City, it's been to the point where most of those who we work with who are detained were not even reported by official bodies, by cops or by any other public agencies. They were reported by people like landlords, by employers, by people down the block who had a grudge against them or who were particularly racist. And so we're seeing unbelievable amounts of private cooperation, whether it's private institutions or even citizens. And some of the examples of that is that two universities in New York handed over their lists of all students with visa expirations to the INS and the FBI. And that's only what we know of. We don't really know of what other institutions have also done this level of information sharing.
McGill has.
Is that right?
Here in Montreal.
And I mean, like, the way that law enforcement agencies are using this cooperation to circumvent, like, what their legal mandates are, I mean, granted, they do it all the time. But, like, so the INS really can't, like, knock down a citizen's door and arrest a citizen, right? So it needs the FBI present. And the FBI can't really investigate people that aren't breaking national law. So they need the NYPD to do the dirty work for them, you know? And the NYPD really can't get into a welfare office and take people's records to find out their immigration status. So they need welfare agencies to do that for them, or they need schools to do that for them. And so, like, there's developing, like, this sophisticated network with which people are circumventing, like, all types of laws. I mean, granted, these laws were messed up to begin with anyway. But on top of that, in case there's a legal challenge, well, I didn't knock down the FBI. I didn't knock down this person's door. The police did it, you know. I didn't arrest this citizen. The FBI did it, you know. I didn't do a background check. The INS did it, you know. And just the really sophisticated ways that they're using one another to, like, to keep their hands off of any type of legal challenge.
And it doesn't only end in terms of the domestic reach of information and data sharing. The INS is also buys, actively purchases databases from foreign countries, from both private institutions like banks in Latin America to public institutions in foreign countries, and utilizes those databases internally within the U.S.
And they've always openly cooperated with things with institutions like Interpol, always. And even local bodies, like, even though, once again, they're using the war on terrorism as an excuse and as a strategy to say, well, this is why we're starting to cooperate with local bodies. For the past couple of years in Queens County in New York, they've been doing trainings with the local prosecutors and local district attorney's offices to encourage district attorneys, when they're charging immigrants, to charge them with deportable offenses, charge them with offenses, to make them plead guilty to offenses that last longer than a year so they can be deported. That type of cooperation and instruction and teaching has been going on for quite a few years in New York now.
Just to explain that, criminal detention is probably the largest category of immigrant detention in the U.S., where if you're convicted of a crime where on the books that crime can get you 1 year of time, then that's a deportable offense. Right after you finish your time or your community service, you're immediately put into an INS jail and your deportation proceedings are started. And that can last anywhere from 3 months to 3 years. The longest person we know in INS detention in the U.S. has been there for 7 years.
We've been working.
Got a few minutes left. But one of the things we wanted to talk about also is that there's a lot of talk out there in the U.S., especially by civil liberties organizations, as this of what's going on now simply an issue of civil liberties. Well, we want to bring it back to the fact that we're talking about low-income people of color, third world people. And for these communities within the U.S., there's really never been civil liberties. So this is not anything new, and this is not a question of, I'm going to now, you know, immediately after September 11, they were interviewing all these middle-class white folks on TV saying, well, I'm ready to give up my civil liberties, you know, take them away, get rid of the terrorists. The fact is, our communities never had them in the first place, you know, and so for us, the struggle and the fight of detention being put at the forefront is really the crux of both two major movements that are really going to have to be at the center of social justice and the fight and the struggle for justice within North America, and that's the immigrant rights movement and the racial justice movement. The racial justice movement has had years and years of history of fighting racial profiling and criminalization and social control, basically the elimination of movements liberation within the U.S. of people of color through the prison system. And now we're seeing that starting to happen with the immigrant population within North America. And immigrants are now, we're now seeing lines being drawn across the basis of citizenship. If you're a citizen or you're not a citizen, an apartheid state being created around that line. And so for us, the work is clear. In the coming years, we want to bring together those two movements, and for us, that means both immigrant and non-immigrant people of color who need to be at the center of the struggle. And it's high time, you know, we stop talking about people being detained and imprisoned as objects to help or to save or to hear from, but as active agents and organizers, because we know from our work that the people inside are the best organizers, and they have been organizing. And what we need to do is facilitate their power from the outside.
And I think what, in terms of the work that was that's being done in the States by, like, people that work in grassroots organizations and the type of analysis and the type of wording that was being put out, I mean, on the very liberal level, even on the progressive level, you have a bunch of people that, in a lot of ways, seem like they just want to forget about this. The work was about getting folks to get deported right away, you know, and about getting, like, getting this as part of historical record. People have actually told us this and do some of this work that were from more mainstream organizations. Like, you know, history has showed us that this is wrong, as if this wasn't an active process. And without the involvement, without, like, the leadership of people that were directly affected, communities that were directly affected, this would become about the civil liberties of people in general, meaning, like, white middle-class people. Like, their civil liberties on attack. Or it would be about, well, let's keep this as part of public record, so like 10 years later, 20 years later, when we're reading the history books, we can talk about how bad this was, like the Japanese internment, and like, you know, all these other things that happened. You know, literally, like, there's this desire to, there's this desire of well-meaning people to either leave this in the realm of civil liberties or create this as a realm of history that you can just talk about. Well, after September 11, you know, honey, this is what happened, this is what happened. No, I mean, there's really no, like, real, like, discussion about this is actually happening in communities, and this is a process that's going to continue. And even when the first wave of racial attacks is over, the first wave of detention is over, this is going to affect the day-to-day lives of people that look like us for the next few decades.
And what we're seeing, you know, it's really important to remember that what we're seeing now is only the tip of the iceberg. These policies have been in the works for many, many years. Now they've had the full green light to go ahead, and they're only beginning in the level of reach they're going to have in all parts of society, especially for people already marginalized in the North. One thing that we just want to end up with saying is, shit, I forgot.